First, though, a powerful new novel set in Afghanistan. Nadim Aslam was born in Pakistan in 1966, and when he was 14, his family moved to Britain, fleeing the Islamist regime of President Zia-ul-Haq. That was because Nadim's father was a prominent writer and a communist. When Nadim was in his late 20s, he published his first novel. It was called Season of the Rainbirds. That was in 1993. And it was set in rural Pakistan. It won several awards and it marked him out as an exciting writer. Well, his new book, his fourth novel, is called The Blind Man's Garden. It's set in the months immediately following the 2001 attack on the World Trade Center. It's about Gio and his foster brother, Mikhail, two young Pakistanis who secretly enter Afghanistan, not to fight against the Americans, but to help care for wounded civilians. But they are plunged into the unspeakable horrors of the war. And then their father, Rohan, comes searching for them, an act of love for which he pays a terrible price. Nadim, welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you with us. Now, you open with an arresting proposition. The very first sentence is, history is the third parent. Can we talk about that idea?
Of course. we've lived through an extraordinary decade, beginning with 9/11 and ending with the Arab Spring, Muhammad Atta's suicide at one end and Muhammad al-Bouazizi's suicide at the other end. Muhammad al-Bouazizi was the, if you recall, Tunisian fruit seller who set himself on fire in December 2010 and died the following month, and his death sparked off the Arab Spring. And between these two moments, we had the war on terror, the call to jihad, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, the murder of Benazir Bhutto, the killing of Osama bin Laden. So this clash between an incomplete understanding of the East and an incomplete understanding of the West seems to have taken place. Not long ago, I was on Google and I typed in Pakistan is. And the four autofill choices I was given were dangerous, evil, stupid, a terrorist country. You type in America is, and the choices you are given are not the world, evil, not a country, but a business. So I wanted to find a story which will take the historical moment, this decade, this historical moment, and encompass as many of these elements that I have mentioned earlier, without losing anything as a work of art. I mean, first and foremost, it's a novel. It's not nonfiction. And as a writer, I always say I can't tell people what to think. I tell people what to think about. That's where the first sentence came from, really. I wanted to say that the decade, we now have to see the children that it has spawned, what it will go on to, what those children will go on to do.
Hence the line, history is the third parent. We have a mother and a father. And we have history. So the book unfolds, and right at the start we meet this very thoughtful, very gentle man, Rohan, who's the founder of an Islamic school with very poetic principles. I mean, he has very poetic principles. Can you just tell us a little about who he is, what he believes in?
It's interesting that, I mean, he's the blind man of the title. And the garden, which sometimes a garden is a garden, but sometimes if the reader wishes to look deeper into it, it could be a metaphor, it could be a symbol for something else, and I'm perfectly willing for the reader to look at it just as a normal garden, but for me it stands for Pakistan. At one point, the school at the center of this garden, which is now called Ardent Spirit, originally it was called Pure Land, which means in Urdu, Pakistan. And I wanted to show how this man who founded this school and who planted this garden with the help of his wife, with really sort of, as you say beautifully, these poetic principles that he wanted to hold on to, the golden age of Islam and what Islam had achieved through its gentler and instincts. How then those instincts got corrupted once the garden was planted, meaning once Pakistan came into being, slowly other forces came in and they decided to bring in their own idea of what Islam was. And they eventually marginalized Rohan. And his own ideas hardened, his wife died. And now, of course, he regrets letting the school fall into the hand of the Islamists. But now it's too late.
Yes. There's a marvellous image that he has, that he's collected dust from the six great cities of Islam, Mecca, Baghdad, Cordoba, Cairo, Delhi and Istanbul, and he's scattered the dust of those six cities as the kind of foundation of the garden.
Absolutely.
And all of this has been corrupted in his mind because the militants have taken over his school.
As I said, that is the ideal of Pakistan, was that. But, you know, At one point, I say that the boundary wall of the garden is draped in poet's jasmine, which is Pakistan's national flower. So little hints are there all the time that even though it's a normal everyday garden, I'm trying to hint at something bigger.
I won't lead you through the entire story, Nadeem, but let's just give the listener a taste for what happens. So he has these two sons, his own teenage married son, Gio, and a foster son called Mikhail, and they're drawn into the conflict. So he goes off on a holiday with them, basically, and they slip away from him and cross the border into Afghanistan. And as we might expect, things go very badly for them. They get caught up in the horrors of the war. And along the way, let's not say what happens to each one of them, but one of them gets captured by an Afghan warlord.
Then he's sold to the Americans.
He's sold to the Americans. So that surprised me because I didn't know an Afghan warlord would do that. So who are these Afghan warlords? What's their motive in all this?
Well, their motive is money. The Americans said, we will pay you $5,000 for every quote-unquote terrorist you bring us. And I don't know how it was checked by the Americans that these people that were being handed over were Al-Qaeda or Taliban. So there are stories and there are actually news reports of warlords who actually did precisely that. In order to earn money, they actually kidnapped people and sold them to the Americans who then proceeded to
torture them.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the official term is enhanced interrogation techniques, but we can call it torture. And I wanted to highlight that. I mean, it doesn't come as any surprise to me that the fact of torture, because I grew up in Pakistan, and anyone who has been to a police station in Pakistan knows what happens in Pakistani police stations. Prisoners are routinely tortured. There is a joke, which is in the novel, about Pakistani police, that someone once lost an elephant. And he went to the Australian police and they couldn't find it. They went to the British police. The British police couldn't find it. They went to the American police and the American police couldn't find it. He came to the Pakistani police and they said, give us a day. And the following day they came back and they were leading a camel. And they were beating the camel, and the camel was saying, I am an elephant, I am an elephant, I am an elephant. So to me, it didn't come as a surprise that someone would wish to torture someone. But the surprise was that we in the West, who on the one hand, after 9/11, were going around saying, Islam needs an enlightenment. Islam needs to examine some of its assumptions and principles and know and enter the modern world. On the one hand, we were saying that to Muslim countries, and on the other hand, we were forgetting the principles of enlightenment ourselves. And we were busy torturing people and calling it enhanced interrogation techniques. So that was the reason why I wanted to bring that into the novel.
This is Books Nuts Daily on RN with Michael Cathcart, and my guest is Nadeem Aslam. His new book is called The Blind Man's Garden. And Nadeem, you write with a kind of vivid rage about the atrocities of war, the kind of passion that you're showing now. And alongside it, however, there is this exquisite beauty, brutality existing alongside scenes of wonder. When did that juxtaposition first strike you?
I always say that I never think of an audience when I'm writing, and I don't. My writing is an exploration of my own life, my own encounter with this thing called existence. And I happen to be a politically minded person. I always say that the news is the most emotional program on TV and radio for me. But part of my everyday existence is looking at a leaf and falling into rapture at its beauty, looking at a bird in flight. So I always say that I am my books. If you don't like my books, you will not like me. So I can't really say whether I sit down and saying, okay, I'm going to make one page brutal and the next page gentle. You know, sometimes a writer perhaps shouldn't examine too much of what happens when you sit down to write. You enter a state of grace, really. And beyond that, what happens, you never know. Though, of course, I do know that there is a kind of dreamy intensity to my prose. I do know that I use images. But that's part of the technique, in that I'm using these images to help reinforce my storytelling.
Sometimes quite extravagant images. And I have read critics who think that they're too extravagant, but I didn't feel indeed. That. I thought the extravagance of the images, of the tenderness, of the beauty, matched the extravagance, the horror of the war. There was a kind of scales, a kind of balance, or a kind of, you know, clash of two ways of being in the world. I wanted to read you a quotation here. You say, this is about war, you say, they want the birth of a new world and will take death and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it until that birth results. And I take it that you're talking about all sides in this war.
Absolutely, absolutely. As I mean, I've said it so many times, boundaries and frontiers don't mean anything to me. I could live anywhere if I loved someone. So the idea of America, the idea of Pakistan, the idea of Australia as a nation means nothing to me. And so I am not on anybody's side. So that is where that comes from, that my connection is always with the human beings.
Nadim, the West is fighting partly because the anti-Western propaganda of the militants is so menacing. And the possibility that terrorists may attempt an even bigger attack on the West, bigger than 9/11, is terrifying. Do you think that could happen, or is that all just propaganda from the warmongers, as it were?
Well, I mean, I don't know. And but as I said earlier, that I can't tell people what to think. My job is to take the situation on the ground and say, this is what is happening, and I'm going to place all these panels next to each other, and you can decide whether the way we are proceeding is the right way. And I mean, you say that the propaganda of the fundamentalists is menacing. But I mean, I now go to Pakistan almost every year. For a long time, I couldn't afford to go back. Now that I can, I do. I spend months there and I talk to these. I go and talk to the mullahs. I go and talk to the boys in the madrasas. And you really have to listen to them. I mean, the most recent report we have, which was in September 2012, and this is in Western newspapers, not the propaganda from somewhere in Pakistan or somewhere in the Muslim country. What the most recent report we have is that these drone attacks that President Obama is carrying out in Pakistan's tribal area, known as Waziristan, where part of the blind man's garden takes place, just one in 50 of these surgical strikes is taking out a militant, meaning in order to kill one militant, we are killing 49 innocent people. And people know this. So when you go and talk to people in Pakistan, and when you go to the tribal areas, as I have been, this is the figure that they give. So there is a reason for the menacing talk. I don't know whether you recall Trayvon Martin, the 16-year-old African-American boy, young man who was killed in Miami last year on suspicion of being a burglar. President Obama went on TV and said that we need to examine race in America. The fact of the matter is that if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. That's what President Obama said. Now, this is not taking anything away from dear Trayvon Martin's death. But I would like to say to President Obama that, sir, if I had a son, he would look like one of those 49 drone victims over there in Pakistan. Now, who are on a good day being killed on suspicion of being a terrorist. On a bad day, they're not even that. They are just collateral damage. So, you know, you say that the rhetoric is menacing from the fundamentalists. You have to examine where is it coming from. This is what a novelist does, that you take a character and you show that he or she is a flesh and blood human being. He had a childhood, he had a life in school, he had best friends, he has a favorite food, he has a favorite song, he has a favorite season, he has a bad memory, he has a good memory, and you create a human being, and then you take him away and throw him into this American prison, and then you have him tortured. So the reader will not only feel the pain of what that character is going through, he or she will also feel what the people that love this boy are going through. This is what a novelist does. This is what I think nonfiction can't do. And I think this is what, because nonfiction will just say that X number of people were tortured during President Zia's regime in the 1980s in Pakistan. But fiction actually creates a human being and then creates another human being and creates another human being. And then it does something to one of them. And we see the effect not only on person A, but we see effect on person B, person C, person D. And more importantly, we see the effect on the reader. You say that the books are quite brutal in places, but I always say that my books always end on a note of hope, and there is a constant baseline of hope. These people are thrown into these extreme circumstances, extreme situations, but I defy any reader to read my story and say that they didn't feel for the person who was in that terrible situation, and they didn't feel their bravery and their sense of dignity and their sense of honor in how they met that situation. That, I think, is where the hope comes from.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. My guest is Nadim Aslam, and we're talking about his book, his powerful book, The Blind Man's Garden. I mean, we're hearing, Nadim, from the passion with which you're talking to us, how driven you are to write. And I wondered how you insulate yourself from despair. I mean, you make yourself so raw, so available, so open to suffering on an unimaginable scale. You let it pass through you. You write it in ways that are visceral. This must come at a cost.
I mean, I always say that I begin with a subject matter. If you ask a writer, how do they begin to write? How does a novel come to them? Some of them will say, well, a number of characters appeared and I decided to explore what those characters were, etc. And then a novel was formed. Some would say the storyline came to me. Some would even say an image came to me. I always begin with the subject matter. And then I go and look for characters which will best help me define all the complex layers of that subject matter. So all the hope in it, all the despair in it, what caused it, what could end it. So I always say that the paper is the strongest material on the planet, that things under which a mountain would crumble, you can place it on the paper and the paper will hold it. All love, beauty at its fiercest, all despair, all rage, you can place it on a book. Place it on the page. So whether or not it comes at a cost to the person who's making that novel, I think that is a secondary thing. And I think that shouldn't really...
Yes, but that person is you. I mean, you're talking about that person as if it's somebody else. That person is you. I mean, in the publicity that comes with this book, we're told that you really punish yourself, like no other writer I've ever met, that you taped over your own eyes to get a sense of blindness, not just for a day or two, but for two or three weeks.
Yes, I did it. So what happened was that I began to write this book, which took 4.5 years to write. And so I went and talked to visually impaired people, but I don't have the kind of temperament which can make me be at ease with people very quickly so that I can ask them very intimate questions. So I went and I arranged interviews and I spoke to any number of blind people, but the questions I wanted to ask, the visceral questions I wanted to ask, I just couldn't bring myself to ask them. And a year went by. So in the end, I said, okay, let's do it ourselves. I'm going to just tape shut my eyes. I wouldn't say that I lived as a blind man, because I think that would be a disrespect, because I had the choice at any given moment to untape my eyes and begin to see, which a normal blind person doesn't. So I did it for a week, and 24/7 I lived with my eyes taped shut, and at the end of that week, when I took off the tape from my eyes, I was shocked. I was standing in front of a mirror because I was covered in bruises. My face, my neck, my chest, my hands, my belly, my thighs, my shins, because during the previous week I had been bumping into things, and I had totally forgotten that each one of those hits was actually leaving a record on my body, and it was almost as though I had been assaulted without my knowing it. So I did it again the following year, and I did it again for the following year. So in total, I was without my eyes, without the use of my eyes, for 3 weeks over the course of the next 3 years. Mm. And the things I learned were very important. One day, accidentally, my hand touched something warm, and my head flooded with the color red. And I decided to try that again a few hours later to see if it would happen again. And it did. So now in the novel, Rohan, the blind man of the novel, says that when I want to remember the color red, I will touch something warm. And one day I heard rain, and I slowly made my way to the window, and I opened the window and I put out my hand. And when the raindrops fell on the palm of my hand, the first image in my head was the twinkling of stars. And now Rohan says, and when I want to remember the twinkling of stars, I will put out my hand into the rain. But I would like to stress that no amount of putting myself through any of this would matter if I did not use the research that I took, if I did not present it to the reader artfully in the novel. If any of these things that I had learned, if they had been clumsily presented to the reader in the novel, it just wouldn't matter at all. So once again, I would reiterate that the novel is the important thing.
Well, the bruises were certainly worthwhile. Nadim Aslam, thank you for being my guest here on the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Nadim Aslam. His book is called The Blind Man's Garden. It's published by Faber and Faber. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily.